Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And the horn is running hot and true on both streams, both headon.live and whiterosesociety.org's multiple streams. It's Friday. It's the final Friday of April 2018. I went walking about the magnificent acre today and discovered that spring is desperately trying to arrive. We got a little taste of it today. Not going to get much in the way of taste in the next couple of days, but that's okay. I got barbecuing to do over the weekend because it is, in fact, the weekend. The 2 days that I don't spend behind the microphone, I was struck. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. We are here on the 27th day of April 2018, engaged in a week of fundraising-free radio. That means we have thanks to send out, but no fundraising to do on air. So thanks go out to Susan in Massachusetts. Thank you so very kindly, Susan. And thanks go out also to Robert in Australia. Thank you very, very kindly indeed. Thanks to both of you. And, of course, thanks to Tony and Chico, who put forward the matching challenge that got met yesterday. Thank you, and thank you to our new subscribers. That's wonderful. Those are more steps toward having enough subscribers for me never to do on-air fundraising again. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But thank you to Susan and thank you to Robert in Australia. Thank you very kindly. So the weekend's here. It's Friday on the front porch. Here in about, 56 minutes or so, we will fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable and have what I hope will be a rollicking good end-of-the-week conversation. You, of course, are invited to participate in Friday on the Front Porch. All you need is access to Skype. After that, it's easy. But let me make it abundantly clear, because there's still, for some reason or another, there's still a little bit of confusion. If you want to participate in Friday on the Front Porch, well, Sparky moderates that. That means you have to connect with Sparky, okay? Because it's a real booger for me to do here because I do a whole lot of other things as well at the same time. And adding one more plate spinning on one more stick, well, I'm running out of toes. But anyway, if you want to participate in Friday on the Front Porch, you must send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, one word, SparkyDunc. When Sparky gets your contact request, he will then add you to the group, or as I say here, show you the breadcrumb trail that leads to the room where we have the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. Okay? That's how that works. We used to have other means. If I ever get to the point where I can add another cell phone into the mix, well, we'll do that. But, or God knows, you know, drop another 3K on a telephone hybrid system. We could have, four, up to four. That's the way that thing works. Up to four different people tied into the system on four different, landline phones. But that's not how it is right now. It's strictly Skype. And it is strictly Skype through Sparky, not through Bob Kincaid Horn. Okay? So just trying to make that clear. All right? So we'll start that conversation here in, what, 55 minutes or so, right? Me, right now, I'm signed into the chat room. You can sign into the chat room, too, by going to headon.live and picking out a screen name and a password. You'll be greeted by Anatole and Silent R. Lamar and VT Blom and longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, is not folding space like he used to just because of the way the chat room works. That's all the logistics for Friday on the front porch. Okie doke. So make your plans for about, an hour from now. No, I said the weekend is coming. And I've got, it's a process. First, I rubbed the pork butts. Yeah, I know, that just sounds dirty, doesn't it? And then I had an idea, and we'll find out if it works. I got to thinking, what if you were to treat a pork shoulder, which is what a pork butt is, what if you were to treat a pork shoulder the way you treat corned beef? And so I used that, the spice mix in the brine, added in some Szechuan peppercorns. And after it rested and everything, into the brine it went. It is submerged beneath the briny deep, even as we speak. And, sometime, probably about 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, whenever I stumble out of bed and get that first cup of decaf going, I'll build the fire and try to make sure that it stays right around, not much more than 225. And pour the smoke to it for about a half an hour to an hour. I'm going to use a combination of cherry and hickory. I don't know. That'll work for me. And about 8 o'clock tomorrow night, pull it off the smoker, and I'll make some of that wonderful, wonderful, spicy, hot yellow slaw to go with it, and there should be some pretty freaking awesome barbecue to be had by tomorrow evening. Yeah, they're pretty good to me up at the Wiggling Pig, and I get a little price break, because, local, and try to keep it in the community and everything, and it's so much better than buying it at Wally World or right. Just flat can't get pork butts at Kroger anymore for some reason or another. Their meat department's kind of fallen down on the job. But that's the plan. That's the weekend's plan, because I'm trying to make things special. Because what's coming around, and it's not till Tuesday, mind you. But I'll be working Tuesday, most likely. But this sort of thing doesn't happen just every day. Tuesday, May the 1st, will be the 25th anniversary of the day that Agnes and I stood on a hilltop in west central West Virginia and took vows to be wedded one unto the other. And then there was the bee dance and the groomsmen with their firearms. And at a distance, the guy with the 30-06 who watched a bee dance through the scope of the 30-06 and couldn't decide which one of us he wanted to shoot first. That was the day we got married. And I catered our own wedding with some help from some dear friends and an offset firebox smoker that has long since gone to its long home. Sucker held up for damn near 15 years. Probably the best one I've ever owned. But I did ribs, and I did pork shoulders, and I did chicken. I'm probably going to do a couple of chickens over the weekend, too. And, you know, we'll have three out of the four kids here to nosh on it, and I think it'll be just a nice time. But that's the plan. And I got to figure out something really, really special to do for Agnes for our anniversary, because I'm pretty sure that Fox and Friends won't let me just call in and rave in a stream of consciousness pastiche of pure madness like they let Donald Trump do for melanoma on her birthday. I cannot tell you, by the way, I cannot tell you how disgusted Agnes is to find out that she shares not just the birthday month, but the birthday week, the same birthday week with melanoma Trump. Well, thank you very kindly for the congratulations, VT Blom, in the chat room. But it's special, and if the weather doesn't look like it's going to be fan-freaking-tastic or anything, Saturday we've got a high of 60 and partly cloudy, but Sunday we've got apparently full sun and 56 degrees. And then anniversary day, Tuesday, is full sun and 76. So, just by way of warning, it's not for sure. It probably won't happen. But I may just, depending on what kind of inspiration strikes, I may decide to take Tuesday off and try to make the whole bloomin' day as special for Agnes as I possibly can. Maybe we can go for a little trail walk in the woods around the gorge again, hold hands and stuff like that. I don't know. They say the 25th anniversary gift is silver. I've been trying to figure out what would be good in that line. Still working on that. Maybe I could get her a silver barbecue. No. But anyway, you see. Yeah. So I'll probably be here Tuesday, but I might not. If it just turns out to be a fantabulous day, come 6 p.m. or before 6 p.m., I'll put out a notice saying, no, the day is just too good, and we're going to celebrate our 25th anniversary, because big days like this don't come around Well, they come around every 25 years. Actually, they come around once in 25 years. Okay? I hope you all can forgive me in that regard. Oh, God. We haven't had to do this in a while. Apparently, Brother Deacon Asa is feeling a little humorous this afternoon. Mm-hmm. Because we have just received a contribution in, wait for it, rubles. This is Fundraising Free Radio, but we've received a contribution in rubles. And now I have to figure out just how many I don't know exactly what's going on here, but it requires me to engage in currency conversion. And it'll probably drive Agent Fred right out of his tiny little mind. Let's find out. Is Squeaky pointing out in the chat room, he says, our 33rd anniversary is May 4th. Nice. Happy anniversary. Upcoming, see, that Tuesday 2nd is Wednesday 3rd. A week from today is Squeaky. Is Squeaky's anniversary. Happy anniversary. Yeah, Brother Deacon Asa with a note. How about some of that sweet NRA moolah? Okay, except. Wow, 1,154.57 rubles translates to $17.90. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. That will cover the I'd say that will admirably cover the costs of the ingredients for the barbecue sauce, because I'll be making that homemade. And I got to thinking about barbecue sauce the other day. You know, the origins of the origins of barbecue are shrouded and lost in the mists and smoke of time. But there is a certain amount of consensus that the Spanish, having met the indigenous peoples, were introduced to the concept. And so I got to thinking, you know, you go to the store, these specialty shops, or whatever, old Uncle Thumbfucks. Genuine old-fashioned Kentucky bourbon barbecue sauce. But it was a long time before white folks got to Kentucky, that dark and bloody ground. I figure if liquor was involved in the earliest barbecue sauces, and this will thrill Flavio to his very soul, it was probably something along the lines of a really raw rum or a cachaca. So I'm wondering about maybe, because I've never done it. I've used tequila in barbecue sauce. I've used bourbon, Irish whiskey. Never used scotch. But I've never used rum in barbecue sauce. And I'm thinking maybe that might be an interesting item to pursue. That could be interesting indeed. Well, thank you, Jim. Jim says, "Well, happy anniversary. I hope you clean as you go." I hope you clean as you go. And then he says, what do you have against music with little syncopation? Stronger Together? It just doesn't really, I mean, doesn't do anything for me. And people know where they can go and hear the song. I usually use songs that have some relationship to the stories involved. Rufus, Jim says, is still in the hospital. I'm sorry to hear it. I hope he gets to come home very, very soon. Ron in Raleigh has a gift idea. Wait a minute, okay. He says you could give Agnes a photo of the Lone Ranger's horse, Silver. Yeah, but you know what? I don't like sleeping on the floor, Ron, and that wouldn't play real well. She might giggle a little bit, but then it'd be, yeah, you smartass. So, right. Meanwhile, as to rum and barbecue sauce, Silent R. Lamar says, use 100-proof rum, please. Well, I'm not looking to blow the barbecue sauce up, Silent R. VT Blom, on the other hand, says, a good dark rum and molasses for a base. Now, I don't know, VT Blom, that might be where we part company, because I don't like a real, real sweet barbecue sauce. I like it kind of thinner and more toward the brutally tangy side. In fact, I was thinking that I might try to talk my friends over at Secret Sandwich Society out of a container of their pickle juice. Pickle juice is a really key ingredient of good homemade barbecue sauce. I think the ideas are coming together here. Steve from Georgia Stan just asked, is Bob doing a 2-hour show? No, there's no reason to stop the program tonight. I was just covering for Malloy last night. By the way, update, I heard from Kathy today. Mike is recovering nicely after his surgery. And I'm told he's groggy and a little cranky. Well, you would be too if you'd just had surgery. I mean, the thing that it was set, the surgery was meant to fix, appears to have been fixed. So, hallelujah. That's good news indeed to know. And I had a blast last night. With those 2 hours covering for Mike in his absence, and get well quick, my friend, and back into the chair and back behind the microphone. Coffee breaks over, back on your head. So that kind of, you know, it's Friday. We're a little more lighthearted on Fridays, right? And we'll get the front porch fired up here shortly. I don't know if we're going to be able to pull it off, but one of my goals for the summer is to actually do a broadcast from the front porch of the mansion here. See how that works out. It could happen. You know, there's Flavio tells me, rum's based on molasses, so why not? That's a no-brainer. But it would make for a sweet barbecue. I don't think it would be overwhelming. No, it wouldn't be overwhelmingly sweet, like adding honey or molasses. I've done those things. Just the other problem with a real thick sweet barbecue sauce is if you're painting it on to something, and that's more usually done with something like ribs. But if you're painting it on to something still over the open fire, it caramelizes and turns into freaking carbon in a heartbeat. You can't turn your back on it for a second. Scott and Punky reminding me, Arthur Bryant's original barbecue sauce, that's out of Kansas City. I've had it. It's good. But I tend to gravitate more toward the higher vinegar contents. I'm just funny that way. Randy in PA says, give Agnes a silver turquoise brooch or bracelet. That would be nice. See how it plays out. Yeah, that's true too. Ron and Raleigh says, you know, a side of those ramp fritters would go well with the pork butt. I have a harder time frying than I do smoking. But, oh, yeah, that would just look it up. Ramp fritters. What was that? Bon Appetit Gourmet Magazine. I'm not sure which. There's a recipe out there for ramp fritters, and it'll just... Talk about food porn. Yeah, Flavio says, I prefer a savory rub. Well, I do, too. And that's why the brine and the pickling spices and all of that stuff is going on even as we speak. So Oh, that's good, too. Give her a silver bullet to keep away vampires and Republicans. That's a story from the family from a long time ago, when the kids were just kids. And a cop who didn't know better pulled her over in the minivan. And she hadn't done anything. But license and registration, ma'am, and proof of insurance. Well, sure. And out from the back of the minivan comes the line, because it came from some comedian, but it worked. Please don't shoot her, mister. If you don't have a silver bullet, you're just going to piss her off. That really happened. We still laugh about it to this day. It's right up there with the big Thanksgiving Kroger story. Ron, in the, I presume, maybe thawing out a little bit north. Ron says, seems to me that a simple blend of molasses, Worcestershire sauce, and some of the packaged Cajun spices would be just the thing for your delicate palate. Adding ramps will help you determine who your real friends and loved ones are in reality. Well, that's what, you know, saute some ramps there to get the, at the very beginning, along with the garlic and the, yeah. Mm-hmm. Got to be careful with the Worcestershire sauce in barbecue sauce. It can overpower in a hurry. Of course, I also like my barbecue sauce to be hot enough to make the imps of hell run for the water faucet. And so it's a matter of collecting some. Sometimes I'll put a few jalapenos with slits in them down the sides. I'll put those on the smoker and let them turn into homemade chipotles. Yes, yes. And then simmer a couple of those in the sauce and take it out and let a crazy person try to eat it if they're so inspired. Jim wants to engage in a discussion about my taste in music. I'm not so inclined. He says my taste in music doesn't include soul and rhythm. Well, yeah, it does. It's just that I work for context. I don't just throw random songs in there, okay? Let that be an end of it. He says, show a little respect for your gay cohorts. Respect all day long. But I tend to try to find songs that fit within the context. Jesus, why are we even talking about it? But anyway, a long time ago, and it's an obscure little joke, but it's a good one. The story has it that a Jesuit and a Dominican are sitting around chatting over a mug of ale. And they get to talking about the history of their respective orders, the Dominicans and the Society of Jesus. And the Jesuit says to the Dominican, "Well, why was your order founded in the first place?" And the Dominican says, "Well, our order was founded to eradicate the Albigensian heresy." How about you? And the Jesuit says, "Well, our order was founded to eradicate the Protestant heresy." And the Dominican says, "Well, I belong to the better order." And the Jesuit says, "Well, why is that?" And the Dominican says, "You don't see a bunch of Albigensians wandering around now, do you?" So, I mention that because of a story that has emerged from the halls of Congress. Oh, wait, time out. We're back. We're still in food porn. Note from Kim and Malin in New Jersey. Malin just picked our first ramps of the season hours ago. having them tonight sautéed with a little garlic, mushrooms, onions, olive oil, and butter served over a couple of grilled steaks. The grill is heating up right now. Yum, we can hardly wait. Keep the coals going. I'll be there in a minute, Kim and Malin. Oh, that'd be real tasty. Now, the question is, how near are your neighbors? And I'm not talking, well, maybe both spiritually and in terms of geographic proximity. Unless they're Ramp fans, well, you might have a problem. Yeah. Meanwhile, Ron says garlic flavored Tabasco is a nice compromise. Yeah, it is. By the way, I learned a trick about hot sauces. If the first ingredient on the ingredient label in your hot sauce is water, it means that your hot sauce has been reconstituted from dried ground chilies. And that affects the flavor profile. If peppers is the first ingredient, that means that whole peppers have been pickled and fermented and then taken forward in the hot sauce process. So, you know, just file that away. Watch your labels. Very funny. Very, very funny there, Laurel. What's the difference between Trump's doctor and Trump's lawyer? One drinks a fifth and the other pleads the fifth. And anyway, the reason I brought up the old chestnut about the Dominican and the Jesuit has to do with the rather surprising story that came out of the Congress. America, the Jesuit Review, has one version of the story. Report, House chaplain, a Jesuit priest, was forced out by Speaker Paul Ryan. And it has to do with Patrick J. Conroy, S.J., S.J. standing for Society of Jesus. And he became chaplain of the House of Representatives in 2011. And has served, I guess, appropriately. He's done a good chaplaining job since 2011. But Jesuits are known, as far as the Roman Catholic clergy is concerned, Jesuits are known for their passion for knowledge and reason, intelligence, learning. And even a soupçon of militancy from time to time, hence the old joke. They failed in their initial mission of slaughtering all the Protestants. But, Father Patrick Conroy did what chaplains do. He opened every session of the House of Representatives with a prayer to the to everybody there's in, well, most invisible friend. I mean, I guess you could argue that it wasn't, I mean, Witzelo Pochtli was probably not invoked, nor Shipe Totec or Pachamama or any of the indigenous, no. Earlier this month, Father Conroy submitted his resignation. And in that resignation letter, he said, I bet Paul Ryan was not expecting this. Where's a good excommunication when you need one? Father Conroy wrote, "As you have requested, I hereby offer my resignation as the 60th chaplain of the United States House of Representatives. I'm sure Paul Ryan read that and went, son of a... Why'd he have to put as you requested? The whole thing stems from the fact that back during the great big the tax scam that was ramrodded through the Congress, before one particular session of Congress, one morning, Father Conroy prayed as follows. Not that anybody was listening, but that's me. He prayed, as legislation on taxes continues to be debated this week and next, may all members be mindful that the institutions and structures of our great nation guarantee the opportunities that have allowed some to achieve great success while others continue to struggle. May their efforts these days guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans. And I guess that's been bubbling and simmering and percolating among the good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, and otherwise Christians with all those family values of the Republican Party for about 5 months. And so Paul Ryan, who has announced that he's scared to death to run for re-election, I mean, that he's resigning to spend more time with his family, felt free enough now that he could try to throw a member of the Society of Jesus under the bus. As Steve in New York notes, as you requested, hey, Bob, I almost think Father Conroy deserves a cowbell. Well, let's be generous. Yeah, as you requested. What's Paul Ryan, who, by the way, professes to be a devout and faithful Roman Catholic, what's he supposed to do? Lion priest! As retired member of the House of Representatives, John Dingell tweeted earlier, who fires a priest? You'll forgive me if I heard it in Mike Myers' Austin Powers voice. Who throws a shoe, honestly? Who fires a priest? Well, I mean, there is some historical precedent, and frankly, you could argue that Father Conroy got off easy. Because once upon a time, there was a fellow named Henry II who had about all he could stand from his former drinking and whoring buddy, Thomas Becket. And while mingling amongst his barons, mumbled something to the effect of, will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? And the next thing you know, there's old Father Thomas, well, actually Archbishop of Canterbury, Your Holiness Thomas of Canterbury, right. And he's doing the thing with the wine and the chalices and the gongs and the incense and the crackers. And the next thing you know, some guys with knives came up and ventilated him with extreme prejudice. So at least Paul Ryan didn't do that to Father Conroy. But he did make it abundantly, well, there were two prongs of the complaints. One was that he hurt the tender, delicate, and snowflake-like feelings of Republicans who just want to make America great again by giving away everything to the top 1% of the country. And then there was some mumbling about the fact that,
Well, you know, we feel like we probably need somebody there in the chaplain's office. It's an actual family man.
I'm guessing we won't be getting any Episcopalian female members of the clergy anytime soon.
No.
Nancy Pelosi is also. Did you know that both the minority leader and the Speaker of the House are both Roman Catholics? Nancy Pelosi's Roman Catholic. And she didn't take too kindly to the sacking of Father Conroy. But with an update to the story, earlier today, even though this kind of, as the saying goes, stunk in the nostrils of the Almighty, the House of Representatives rejected a proposal today to investigate the circumstances surrounding the dismissal of Father Conroy. As Steve in New York notes, and Steve is a proud and practicing Roman Catholic, so he's kind of got a dog in the hunt here. Steve says we can't have a chaplain being all Christian-y talking about the poor and stuff. Or even being overly generous to the rich who already have more than enough. No, can't have that. That's unbearable. That's intolerable. Apparently, in an attempt to create some notion of balance, the folks over at America, the Jesuit Review, wrote, members of Congress from both parties expressed shock at the forced resignation. The Hill reports, with one congressional aide telling reporters that the speaker was dismayed. Aw, poor snowflake. Poor Paul Ryan was dismayed. Poor Paul Ryan, who would probably, to this day, be shoveling shit somewhere on a dairy farm in Wisconsin, had he not had Social Security to carry his parasitic ass survivor benefits. If he, without those, no, he wouldn't be Paul Ryan. If he hadn't had those little lips of his latched squarely and firmly onto the federal teat, who knows where he'd be? Maybe he'd still be driving the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. Hey, kid, you want a hot dog? Mm-hmm. But no. He was dismayed, Paul Ryan was, by that there very prayer that called upon the members of the Congress to be mindful of the institution and structures of our government that guarantee some modicum of decency to people who, you know, aren't wealthy Republican donors. I mean, that's the way I read it. That's certainly not what Father Conroy said. He said it much more politically. But that's what it boils down to. That and him not being a family man. What, is Jerry Falwell Jr. looking for a job as a house chaplain? You know, maybe they got a point. Maybe the House of Representatives needs a real good, honest-to-goodness, oil-anointing, strychnine-swigging, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking, serpent-handling chaplain. Hey, Speaker. Yeah, come here. Let's test your faith. I got a rattlesnake. You want a rattlesnake? Get him one of the warm ones, boys. Oh, no, that's okay. That's your job as chaplain. You just go ahead and handle the snakes by yourself there, Father. Oh, you don't have to call me Father. I'm only an Anabaptist. These people. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out the fact that that the Congress, based upon the way the Constitution's written, mind you, no mention of the Almighty or gods or deities or demi-deities or goddesses or pixies or leprechauns or unicorns or any of that shit. Given that none of those folks show up in the Constitution, and that in fact there is mandatory language saying that that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and that there shall be no religious test for holding office, I think it's safe to say that having a chaplain of the House or of the Senate or of any particular branch of government is anachronistic, to say the least, and probably unconstitutional on its face. But gosh, we can't be challenging something like that because the precious little religious snowflakes would have a baby. Yeah. Oh, the other thing, that there was one other thing that that pissed off the good, God-fearing, upstanding, family values, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, and otherwise Republicans. Father Conroy, got to look around when you say this and say it kind of low-like. Father Conroy actually invited a Muslim to pray to his Allah God before one of the sessions of the House. No, really. What's next? A Hindu? No, there's been a Hindu. You know what? I'm all for equality, and I really would like to see. A priest of Xipe Totec come in. You know, the Dear One Flayed. That's what he was known as. Come in and maybe flay the skin off of alive. It has to be alive, or Xipe Totec cannot be reborn in the spring. Flay the living skin off of a Republican member of the House, or maybe they could get an intern to volunteer to be flayed alive and then have their skin worn around and their thigh bone used to bless the varied and sundry members of the House of Representatives. You know why? Because it's a legitimate religion. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think it should be the job of the chaplain of the House of Representatives and the job of the chaplain of the Senate henceforward to make the Congress of the United States a welcoming place for every sort of religion. Maybe, you know, somebody could come in and barbecue a brace of doves in the middle, you know, burnt offering, pleasing unto the nostrils of the Lord and all of that shit. Or maybe a Pontifex, why not? The Pontifex Maximus, not the Pope guy, but the one of Divine Jove could lead a great big-ass white bull into the middle of the House of Representatives and get that big hammer that the Romans used and just smite the shit out. And, I mean, it's one of those things that happened. They put wreaths on the horns of the bull and everything and led him to the, and then it whacked him with a big ass hammer right in the head, and there was some bovine fecal material involved. But I mean, we need to be ecumenical about all this stuff. I mean, I don't think it's fair that just the Christian Protestants and the Christian Catholics and the Christian Orthodox and the various and sundry forms of Jews and the various and sundry forms of Muslims and the million and one gods of Hinduism and the sky-clad Jains. And I mean, what about the Shinto? Has there ever been a Taoist prayer? Has anybody ever stood in the well of the house and offered up a prayer in the name of Gitche Manadu? I'm guessing not. And so consequently, the whole idea of praying all over the Congress and then going about the filthy business of doing Republican majority stuff, you know what that is? Assuming that the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky is actually real, that's just an invitation to a lightning bolt with a fucking RSVP on it. Now, proving that he is the manifest hypocrite that he is, it was April 16th when Paul Ryan, without mentioning the fact that he had demanded the resignation, issued a statement from the Speaker's office saying, "Father Conroy has been a great source of strength and support to our community." What community is that, Paul? The community of millionaire goddamn Republicans who want to steal every last thing in this country and either put it on the roulette wheel on Wall Street or just hand it straight away to your buddies? "He is deeply admired by members and staff." Notice Paul Ryan doesn't say, "He is deeply admired by me." "Father Conroy's ministry here has made a difference, and we're all very grateful to him." Well, yeah, he did make a difference. He managed to piss off Paul Ryan because he actually managed to remind Paul Ryan that his own alleged savior, Paul Ryan's, would prefer that Paul Ryan not behave like Paul Ryan behaves. So, you know. Oh, now there's an idea. By God, Asa. Gorkling, otherwise known as Chappie Gordon Klingenschmidt, would be perfect for the job of House Chaplain. He could discern the spirits every morning. In fact, if he got hold of him quick enough, he could get Dr. Ronnie to come over and bring him the spirits to discern. Oh, that was a witty one. I'm giving me a cowbell. Mm-hmm. Worked in a Dr. Ronnie joke alongside a Gordon Clean. Whew! Don't try this at home. That was on the fly, even. Yeah. So, maybe someday we'll live in a country where we'll look up. I mean, do the French, because Christianity's pretty well faded in Europe, they, after 2,000 years of Christians slaughtering other Christians and basically making blood scream out from the ground of the entire European landmass. Long about the time of the Enlightenment, they began to figure out that maybe they were kind of better off without all the religion. And so Europe is largely secular. So when the German Parliament meets, do they get prayed at and water thrown at them and hand gestures and the religious hand jive? How about when les états, what is it, les états général? Sorry, I just love to use my terrible French with my terrible accent. When they meet in France, do the priests come in and do the hand jive and with the sprinkler system and do they? Now I kind of figure that the British and the Italians do, and most likely the Greeks. How about the Swedes and the Finns and the Norwegians and the Danes and the Dutch? Do they do that? And yet, somehow or another, they've been doing better as secular countries than they did through the course of 1900 years, give or take, depending on how far north you're talking about. The most pious and puissant Christian nations. Scott and Punky with an observation. The House or Senate chaplain controversy isn't the biggest problem here. Most of the senators and House members buy into that nonsense about sincere-sounding conversations, one way, of course, to invisible entities. It's the lobbyists, special interests, and cash-stuffed envelope-bearing influencers who are the more insidious forces on the Hill. Yeah. And you may recall a while back when a young man, a young hero by the name of Jordan Dirdall Roberts, engaged in conversation on the program after heroically standing up for his principles and refusing to participate in the hunting of immigrants in this country. He made a remark to me on Twitter. He said, yeah, let's do remember that when it comes to Christian behavior, let me get this right. Jordan said, when they ask you, what would Jesus do? Remember, flipping tables and beating the shit out of people is an option. Yes, it is. And that got me thinking, I'm pretty sure Jesus didn't do that, assuming he did it at all. I'm pretty sure he didn't do that silently. I prefer to think that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of his life, I prefer to think that there was some dialogue. Whether it be Yosemite Sam sort of dialogue or maybe the Samuel L. Jackson kind of Pulp Fiction dialogue. But I like to think there was some dialogue there. Don't you? And it's the lobbyist special interests and cash-stuffed envelope-bearing influencers. Those would be the ones that Yeshua would beat the holy out of. And technically speaking, it would be the holy because it was at the hand of... Right. So I thought that was just a good story to get us going for the evening. Kind of set the stage. There's a lot more to talk about as well. As Steve in New York points out, Paul Ryan and all his Christianist pukes really are wretched and disgusting people. I think that's being kind of hard on the wretched. I mean, Yeshua hung out with the wretched. I don't think, Paul Ryan would have Yeshua waterboarded on sight if that little, probably 5'2", curly-headed, bearded dude in a dress were to walk up to him there, say, in the Capitol. Well, hell, he wouldn't get a chance. The Capitol Police would have him in handcuffs and probably tasered a few times before he even got anywhere near Paul Ryan. Yeah. At least that's the way it seems to me. All right, so let's take a little break and fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. Remember, this is for you. This is a chance to get in a freewheeling conversation. You know, we've only got one line, and that means that during most of the week, you can only get in one at a time. But the way the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable is structured, if you send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Well, then, you'll be added to the group. And you can engage in the freewheeling conversation. And you know what? First-timers, this isn't a club. This isn't a clique. And first-timers are more than welcome here. Always. You know, as long as you're not a right-wing, you know, as Steve notes, puke. Oh, I didn't know that. Angela Merkel opposed marriage equality on religious grounds. There's still some of it down. There's still some of it over there. But by the way, there was another awkward meeting with a world leader today, Angela Merkel, who was referred to by some news anchor as Angela. Really? You pronounce a G as an H in German now? Reminded me of the time Rush Limbaugh called Sherrod Brown Sherrod because he was quite sure Sherrod Brown was a black dude. Flavio helping out says, the French laugh at us when the President of the United States says, God bless you, God bless America. They ought to know something, the French, being the home of massacre, chief among them, their St. Bartholomew's. Yeah, they would. They would. Thank you, Flavio. So anyway, we'll fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. You're more than welcome to jump in and participate. This is Conversation Radio, Friday on the Front Porch, one of my favorite days of the week, along with Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. This is The Horn, and, well, I'm Bob Kincaid.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gather round and started talking, Dad and Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was. No matter how hard I try, when he started sweet talking to me, he'd come and tell me everything is alright. He'd kiss and tell me everything's alright. Can I get away again tonight? The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Lord, oh, he was.
Yes, he was.
I love that song, and so says Jim, does he. Son of a preacher man, Dusty Springfield. Yeah, it was between that and the Staple Singers, and I'll Take You There, because, whew, I love that one, too. It's Friday on the Front Porch, and let's see. I hate to hear that, Steve. Steve says, I'd love to join tonight, but I'm overcoming. This is Steve in New York. I'm overcoming a bad cold and am hoarse.
Don't say that, Wilbur.
I just want to wish all my... That would not making light of your... no, just wishing you well, Steve. I just want to wish all my Horn brothers and sisters a wonderful weekend. Not to play favorites, but I need to give my very best to Clarity And Steve from Georgia Stan. Well, that's mighty kind of you, Steve. Mighty kind of you indeed. Meanwhile, note coming from Spring. Elbert in Rhode Island. Bob, I think Paul Ryan's mad because the chaplain reminded him that Jesus wanted rich people to help the poor, hungry, homeless, and those who needed medical care. I'm guessing, Elbert, you're probably right. Because, see, Paul Ryan's Jesus doesn't do things like that. Paul Ryan's Jesus reads Atlas Shrugged, just like Paul Ryan does. Paul Ryan's read Atlas Shrugged more times than he's read the Bible. Or, God knows, the Gospels. You know, because if you believe in it, God does know. And someday there's going to be this thing, we'll call it the thing, we know it's the judgment day, the great getting up morning, but we'll call it the thing, where Paul Ryan has to stand there and St. Pete's going to look at him and go, Paul, you want to explain to me why your Bible's almost untouched, and yet the pages are stuck together in your copy of Atlas Shrugged during the sex, at the places where they have the weird sexy time, Paul? You want to explain that to me, bub? Hang on, I got a call here. What? Yeah, no, really. Tell the imps to get jumping up and down on the bellows. No, lay on extra imps. We're going to need them. You too. No, really, I do. You too. Hey, look, we've all got a job to do. Yeah. God bless you too, I guess. It'd be something. It's almost worth believing for the opportunity to see something like that, isn't it? Okay, let's run over to the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, where, for lo these many years, Sparky has moderated the ingathering of conversationalists. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, is that big and dangling limb still up way up high in your redwood?
I haven't looked lately, but it isn't down on the ground, so it's still somewhere in the redwood.
Well, you know, in ancient mythology, people had the sword of Damocles. You know, you've got a big redwood limb.
I'm kind of handicapped right now to look at trees and stuff.
Back hurting?
No, my knee is finally gone south on me.
Oh, is it time to get a new knee?
I don't know yet. I got to go see the orthopedist first. And you know, with the American healthcare system, I got an appointment in June sometime, I think. Plus, they're sending me a bunch of paperwork. I had to get referred.
Which is not nearly as much fun as getting referred.
No, I just did that.
Well, I mean, pain management, man. I understand.
Well, if the pain level goes up and down, it's just hard to sleep with it. It cramps up at night. My whole leg does.
Oh, no, it's miserable. I've had bad knees all my life, and I'm afraid of, you know, what's out there in the future. That's why I gotta try to make hay while the sun shines, if it ever does. And work my pasty pale white pink doughy white ass off and try to get some weight off of me.
Yeah, well, if you had a health insurance and money, you could probably get injections too.
Well, yeah, and speaking of which,
that's what I'm going to try again first. Ask the doctor about
what, like cortisone injections or something?
No, Orthovisc.
What does that do?
Well, it's made from chicken eggs or something like that. So I've said it's a substance called hyaluronic acid, and what it does is it makes up for the cushion in your knee.
Ah, okay. So like you, okay. So the car, your, what is that? That's called the meniscus. Your meniscus has kind of degenerated over time.
Well, I had two knee surgeries while I was in the Air Force on this knee.
Ooh.
Yeah. One was a medial meniscectomy, which they go in there and they trim up the the meniscus.
A little and off the top, other, right.
Then the other one, before I got out of the Air Force, I had a calcium deposit that was the result of that first surgery. It was about the size of a quarter, and it was on the outside of my knee. Where they cut me open was on the inside, but this thing was on the outside, and it floated around, and it'd go underneath my kneecap and then pop back out again. It make a strange sound. So before I left Thailand, the doctor over there, when I went for separation physicals, told me you got two choices. You can wait for the VA or have it done now. And so he said, I'll give you time to think about it. So I went back to the electric shop, and all the old timers said, you don't want to be screwing around with a VA. You want to get it done now. So I went back, told the doc, I want to get it done now. 2 days later, I was on an airplane headed to Travis, where I had the surgery, back home. And then I had to wait, half a month or something to get discharged at the hospital. I had it real easy the last month I was in the Air Force. Never wore a uniform again.
Well, that worked out nicely. But it comes back around. Yeah, I've got a thing going on, and it's not debilitating, but it's, by the way, welcome to the Cranky People's Health Problem Hour. Now it's called trigger finger.
Yeah.
And my obscene gesture finger on my left hand locks up.
Mm-hmm.
For people who ever, anybody who ever had like Major Matt Mason or Barbie, you know that kind of click, 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 click of their like elbow joints and knee joints? Mm-hmm. That's what this is like. So I'll wake up in the morning and everything else, all the other fingers will move, but my middle finger is folded down against my palm, and I actually have to do that young Frankenstein constable thing where I... you know, and physically move it, and damn, it hurts. And I'll go to pour out my vitamins and pills and stuff in the morning and put them in the palm of my left hand, and then I'll have to pry my middle finger loose again just to be able to throw the pills into my mouth. I'm told that there are injections for that for people who have health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, if you're paying cash, it's probably a blue bajillion dollars.
No, well, it's cheaper than if you have health insurance. And you want to know why?
Why?
Because they have to fight the insurance companies to get paid, so they jack up the price because they have to pay somebody to try and screw with the insurance company. So it was $1,362 when I had insurance. These injections, and then when I paid cash, it was $750.
Either of which could just as well be a million for me, but no, I get your point.
Yeah, well, I had my medical annuity account I could draw off of too, which was kind of cool.
Is that the same thing as a health savings account that the Republicans are all the time going on about?
Well, it's managed by the union. And it's a bitch to get money out of it, and once it's in there, I paid up for Obamacare for a couple of years. Now that I'm retired, you know, I'm on Medicare, and we're 65. But I tried to get reimbursed for all the money I spent with Blue Cross for insurance, and they just wrote me out of plan. I didn't have the right plan. So I wasn't about to fight with them. It was my money. I paid in there. But I'll get it out somehow. Come hell or high water.
Ron and Raleigh just sent me a link to something called Flexogenics, Flexogenix. Non-surgical knee help solution. Interesting. Oh, by the way,
ejected?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I can't read that fast.
Oh.
But something I mentioned earlier that Ron sent along, the ramp fritter recipe is at Bon Appetit. Bon Appetit, BonAppetit.com. BonAppetit.com. Look up Bon Appetit and ramp fritters. The photograph alone is a thing of beauty. I'm surprised they're not on the menu somewhere around here. Yeah, Brother Deacon Ace is rubbing it in. Welcome to the Geriatrics Hour with your host, Bob Kincaid.
Hey, well, we got somebody else wanting to join the conversation that has the same condition or something.
Oh, okay.
Michael in the Bay Area, alias Mighty Mouse.
Oh, hey.
Mighty Mike.
Yeah, Mighty Mouse. Cool. are you there? Are you there, Mighty Mouse?
I don't know if he's going to speak or not.
Okay, well,
he's live.
Okay, cool. Well, maybe he'll jump in when the spirit moves him. In the meantime, let's run over and check in with Steve from Georgistan. Hey, Steve.
What's going on, Bob?
You know, it's a great day to be a West Virginian.
I'm posting your ramp fritter, you know, your staff on crack or your crack staff. We got it covered, so
okay.
It's in the chat room now.
Excellent. And, you know, I guess you could use like a mixture of strong onions and maybe leeks if you can't get your hands on any honest-to-goodness ramps.
Yeah, that would probably work. But, yeah, it wouldn't be the same, though. They saw them at the food line around your area, don't they? Is that what you were telling me?
Occasionally I can get them up at the Wiggling Pig.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, not to belabor this, old folks there, but how's the tooth?
It's still there. I'm still saving up nickels like Mayella Yule.
It shouldn't be there though. That's the thing. We don't want that thing to get reinfected. You'd be right back where you started again. You know.
Yeah. So I just kind of baby it and
chew on one side of your mouth and all that crap. Well, that's
yeah. And after a while, I get tired of the taste of chewing one side of my mouth.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, because all
jaws
the seems like all the fun taste buds are on the other side.
Yeah. Well, you heard what happened to me, and again, I don't want to belabor the old folks there. Last meal, last
okay,
night.
Okay, but wait. You need to use your cranky old guy voice. Ah,
last night of my vacation, at the last meal, I cracked the side molar, and it cost $1,000 to get it fixed.
$1,000, you say?
$1,000 that I didn't have. I had to go on margin to pay it.
Did you have to sign up for the relief?
There's nothing cheap anymore, man. Nothing. $1,000 for a tooth, that is insane, man. Of course, that's the crown.
You know,
go ahead. It's my busting in the air. Go ahead.
Oh, is that Trey in Kentucky, Stan?
Yeah, I just added him.
Did you see a Black Panther's
one? Yeah, I mean, let me mute him if he doesn't answer.
Okay. Yeah, enough about tooth and all that. But
Trey's got a delightful family.
Doing something wrong when it costs a GER to fix one tooth. You know, our healthcare system sucks, man.
Somewhere back in history, there was a determination, and I mean, you can see it in the fact that there are dental schools and medical schools, okay? I mean, if you consider for a moment, if you want to be a doctor who works on livers, you go to medical school. If you want to be a doctor who works on testicles, you go to medical school. If you want to be a doctor who works on tonsils, you go to medical school. Ah, but if you want to work on teeth, you go to dental school. Where's the sense in that?
And it seems like they're farming out every body part now. You know, it used to be you had one family doctor, you'd go see him, and he would take care of you. You know,
no, but I mean, why isn't dental school part of medical school? Why is it a standalone institution? You know, I mean, really, this is a legitimate, you know, why do you have to have a dean of the pay a dean of the medical school and you pay a dean of the dental school? And all the associated administrative staff.
They're all essential to proper health. You're right.
And in that and see in that divide is also, I think, the genesis of the notion that somehow or another taking care of your teeth is not the same thing as taking care of your health, which is as crazy, as 4 o'clock.
There's a doc out called that they have determined that improper tooth care can cause heart disease, autoimmune deficiencies, all kind of things. And they've got it narrowed down to each tooth, you know, will cause this and cause that. So taking care of your teeth is, you're right, it's essential. It's
And yet medical insurance doesn't cover your mouth.
Doesn't cover it. They'll give you two cleanings.
That's,
you know,
just
as far as they go.
Stupid.
We're doing it all wrong over here, Bob. I don't know how they do it overseas. If dental care is included in like a single payer plan, I don't know. Do you?
I'd have to have somebody from points elsewhere tell me how other countries handle it. I mean, Finland, Sweden, you know, because we look to the Scandinavian countries for really the most enlightened approaches often.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not covered under the national health plan there? What about News Ninja Gene is up and about right now. Is dental care part of the NHS in the UK? Don't know. The healthcare plan in Japan?
I was in a hell of a fix. It wasn't like it was a back molar where I could just yank it, you know, for $300-$400. This was one up front. If you just let it be, all your teeth go crooked. So they got you over a barrel, and they know it. But enough about my teeth, Sonny.
Yeah. Tell us about your lumbago there, Steve. Have you had a good... You know, it's been a while since I've had a good mustard plaster.
My prostate's probably the size of Texas. I deserve a cowbell for that.
Yes, you do.
You got a prostate like a medicine ball.
Oh, Lord. This show's went down fast tonight, Bob.
Sometimes it doesn't take any time at all, Steve. You know, I mean, it just doesn't.
Oh, man, but I always enjoy this front porch. I really do. And there's a lot of topicality we can touch on, but it's just, I don't know.
I kind of got to Friday, and you know, it's nice to relax and
talk about your teeth change.
Talk about our bodily ailments.
Sparky Steve is giving out on a bite cracker.
Mandrake, it's time we talked about our precious bodily fluids.
God almighty.
Are you giving me shit, Steve?
Not Steve.
Not me, bro.
Perish the thought. Hey, can you imagine?
Better. This is Trey, Kentucky Stan.
Hey, Trey.
What's going on, brother?
I have to get my colon scoped on Monday morning, so let's kind of talk.
Now,
about
wait a
that.
Minute. No,
yeah,
wait,
good.
Trey.
I'm back.
Okay, here. Okay. No. This is a new Friday on the Front Porch rule. Whenever we start talking about bodily ailments, you have to use your cranky old man voice. You got a cranky old man voice there, Trey?
Well, sonnies, I've got to get my butthole scoped.
Okay. God damn it, that was worthy of an IMAX cowbell.
How's everybody doing?
Well, you know, apart from the lumbago and the mustard plasters and the butthole scoping, I guess we're hanging in there pretty good.
Yeah, the doctor was like, the doctor says, yeah, it's about that time. And I'm like, it's time for what? She kind of kept looking at me, and I went, oh, the scope. So I got to go in and get scoped.
Yeah, the steel eel.
Is that what it is?
The steel eel.
Is that what I have to look forward to?
Yes.
They put you to sleep now, dude, so you'll be okay.
Well, I mean, you're kind of asleep. It's really weird.
Yeah.
You're not really asleep. You're in this twilight state because they can talk to you and engage in conversations with you that you don't know you're having.
Well, what's this stuff I have to drink here? This doesn't look good at all.
Is it the big jug of stuff, or is it a bottle of magnesium citrate?
Merlex.
Yeah.
Merlex.
Magnesium citrate is what it says, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you'll see a piece of bubble gum from 1982.
I figured we'd have fun with this instead of everything else that's going on in the world.
Oh, man, we are completely off the rails and running on dirt tonight. No, there's no...
Well, that's kind of like how I felt when I heard the whole Trump interview. Like, I was sitting there in amazement. Like, this is really happening in real time, right here in front of me.
Well, you know, Sparky sent me a link to...
You know why I sent you that, Bob?
Why?
Because it was what he started talking about, his mind going and everything. And first thing that came to my mind was the gray settlings and...
Oh, the thin gray settlings that slosh around between his ears and pass for brains.
Yeah. And I thought Lawrence, that was what Lawrence should have said.
Hi, Larry. I mean, yeah. But no, you sent me that, and what occurred to me, because he was just sort of, did you notice that he was just kind of slumped over the desk? As if he was in a state of exhaustion. I don't mean like, you know, head on the table or anything. But I thought that set, if they had put him on camera, Sparky, and he'd had an iced tea glass and a 1.75 of JW Dant, it would have been perfect. It would have been completely understandable. I'm sorry, Trey. I rolled right over you. What were you saying?
No. I was fine. I jumped in when I shouldn't have. I was just saying. The utterings of a madman. It just kept getting worse. And then when he tried to get off the phone, he was like, no, I don't need to get off. They were trying to get rid of him.
Oh, no. You know what an IFB is, you know, the little earpiece that only goes in one ear.
Yeah.
And that's how the control room talks to the on-air talent. I would pay money. I would. I'd take up a collection and I would pay money for a copy of the IFB traffic in that moment, because you know that it was not really Steve, Brian, Ainsley, one of you got to get him off the air. No, they're calling from corporate, guys. Okay, they're having babies up there. There's blood on the fucking floor. You got to get him off the air. And that's when Brian and Steve start looking at their hands and you know, generally looking like they're trying to hold back a fart that they know is going to clear the room.
Yes, yes. And like yesterday when you were listening to when you were doing Malloy's show and you did the very first section of that and he got finished and you were like, holy shit, I was laughing so hard. My wife was like, what are you laughing at? I was like, it's just here's what I'm laughing at. Because at the end of that first segment, you were like, holy shit. Even you were like, oh, my God, I've seen this 100 times. And every time I see it, I'm still like, whoa.
And, you know, I don't drink anymore. And, you know, it's not like, you know, I get the shakes or anything. I just can't because of my innards. And it's not very often that I miss it. But I walked into the bedroom after I was after I'd shut everything down with Malloy last night, and I looked at my lovely wife and I said the same thing. I just said, you know, I don't get the shakes, I don't see things, I don't feel like I gotta have a drink. But I looked at her and I said, after today, honey, I said, honey, it would probably be dangerous if I did have a bottle around here, because I'd just finish it. I'd start it and finish it. It was, it was a violation, Trey, of what is supposed to pass for living in reality. And there was a little bit of triggering going on, too, because in the back of my mind, I could hear my ancient grandmother say, Margie, have you seen my shoes?
It's like that situation where, like, your elderly father or mother or grandmother or whatever, it's got to that point where you got to have the family meeting. And it's like, I don't think any family meeting is going to stop this guy. There is no family meeting with this guy.
Well, they're apparently in denial. I mean, I don't know if you looked around on Twitter today, but the right wing did everything but have a parade today because the House announced again, you know, because they announced it earlier. Well, you know, we don't see anything to investigate there with the Russian collusion thing, and they announced it again today for good measure, and they're like, "Woo, party!" God.
Well, isn't there something coming on tonight, like at 9? Instead of Rachel's show, that they're interviewing the Russian lawyer. I saw that.
Oh, yeah, Richard Engel reports.
Yeah. I got to do something real quick, guys. I'm going to put on hold. I'll stay on here, but I got to grab something real quick.
Okay, no worries. We'll move along and check in with, let's check in with Clarity.
A good Friday to you.
Good Friday to you, too. And I didn't know there was more than one, but I'd say this one, it's warmer here, so this one's better than the one they called Good Friday.
Well, I think today marked my first shout-out on your show, all the way from, it's Steve in New York, right?
New York City, yes.
Wow. All the good ones are too far away, aren't they?
Well, it's just a plane ticket.
I'm just, you know, just the notion of someone being sweet on me is just good for my.
Oh, you got it. No, you got lots of kudos after last week. Steve was by far not the only one.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed myself. I did. And yes, the winter's gone. Now the wind's here.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we've got a completely clear sky, but when you look towards the horizon, it's kind of a grayish.
The season of breathing sand, is that it?
Yes. It's, you know, kind of like that Zappa song, Village of the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take the paint off your car and wreck your windows, too. I don't know how the people stand it, but I guess they do.
Frank.
Out in Cucamonga where the turkey farmers run. Yeah. That's a good one.
She had that Camarillo Brillo blazing out along her head. I mean that Mendocino Beano where bugs and flowers had made it red. Yeah.
She had a snake for a pet, an amulet, but she was breeding a dwarf, and she wasn't done yet. She had gray-green skin, a doll with a pin. I told her she was all right, but I wouldn't come in. And so she wandered through the doorway like a shadow from the tomb. She said her stereo was four-way, and I just love it in her room. And I was born to have adventure. So I just followed up the steps, right where she kept her instant stencher. Anyway.
Yes. Yeah. And to think he did all of that stone cold sober.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that too, Bob. I just passed 3 years since I had definitely some stuff that's going on that I would definitely like to be a wee bit number.
Okay, so I'm not the only one then?
Oh, no, Bob. I think whether we like it or not, and as different as we appear on the inside, we still feel the same disgust and dismay that the people that are in power are just unabashed rapers and pillagers, you know, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it, really, until people vote. And then we got a chance of at least putting the brakes on them.
You know, is that the so-called genius of America, Clarity, that we are a people who are just willing to patiently sit around and get fucked until we get a chance to unfuck ourselves?
Well, I think H.G.W. Bush, who looks like he's going to join his wife here pretty soon.
Singing in the choir, Invisible? Yes.
That's right. He said, you know, the checks and balances in the government are there to keep things from changing too fast. You know, and what they call gridlock, you know, is that we've kind of reached a balance of power. But
Clarity, I don't think we're doing it right. Because for instance, we had gridlock because there was a center-right Democratic president who was the wrong color, and so government pretty much ground to a halt. But now we've got some strange complected person who's passing as white, and the gridlock is gone, and you know the flying monkeys are flapping out of the Wicked Witch's tower. I mean, the separation of powers was designed to create, I think, you're right, a certain amount of stasis.
Yeah.
And the system was designed not to change precipitously, so that you wouldn't have to dissolve Parliament in a vat of acid every time there was some sort of a popular hissy. But for all the genius that they had, they never had a clue what was coming. I mean, you can make a historical argument, and Dr. Bill would be handy to have in this conversation. You could make an historical argument that they sort of saw the Civil War coming, you know, 87 years ago, 87 years, not quite a century. They figured there was going to be some sort of problem, you know, that the slavery issue would have to be solved and it probably wouldn't be pleasant. They saw that. And both Adams and Jefferson knew that the revolution and the revolutionary spirit was dead when they each died on July the 4th, 1826. But there were hints. They had hints. They had clues. Hamilton standing pat on his insistence on an electoral college, and the idea being that, well, you know, someday there may be somebody who becomes president who really shouldn't be president, who doesn't have the best interests of the country at heart. And if the people are so stupid that they vote for him in a majority, the Electoral College can come in and stop that shit. Only the Electoral College didn't, and never has. So I think your point is very well taken, Clarity. Sorry, didn't mean to filibobster all over you there.
Oh, that's right. You know, Don Trump is a gangster, and his friends are gangsters too. Don Trump is a gangster through and through. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Don Trump is a liar. Take a look at Don Trump. He thinks that he's Jesus. Take a look at Trump. He says, just bring him on. You know, he's so pig-headed about, you know, proving that, you know, he can do something that's just so amazing, self-congratulatory, with just a very narrow point to what it is, and by trying to dismantle any type of civil social system makes you more vulnerable to rampant militarism. You know, the two go hand in hand, the private sector calls the shots on who gets, you know, education and this and that, and healthcare, you know, it's I can't imagine, you know, saving up enough money to, you know, go in and have a two or three crowns, you know,
fixed. And I have a special program on the Oregon Health Plan, and all they do is, you know, just fill in the holes, and but they'll sell you a crown for about half the market rate. It's $600, and they'll take, you know, $59 a month till, you know, payments until you're paid off, no interest. But my dentist before I had that was a private dentist, and he charged me $1,100 for a crown. So, yes, you know, if you pay cash, you get a better deal. And whoever says that, you know, everybody has the same access is not really being honest, or they just are ignorant of the fact that, you know, we have stratified healthcare in this country. And especially, you know, from the neck up and the neck down, they're like two different domains. And, you know, I'm kind of hopeful that some of my friends that have just, you know, become nurses have a little bit more holistic approach to things. But the approach now, you know, in wellness diet, you know, they actually have to take nutrition classes where before it was, you know, just the biology and the chemistry and the, you know, genetics has been added. So, you know, healthcare really is dependent on education. And when you live in a rural community, most of the people are, you know, are residents, or they're, you know, doing internships and things like that. And you have a high turnover in, you know, healthcare just at a time when we're going through a growth period now. They're building houses on all four sides of town and selling them as fast as they can put them in. So I guess we're one of the sweet spots in rural America, where in West Virginia, parts of western Kansas, well, all the plain states, if you're not allied with some big corporation, you're running out of business. The communities that don't have enough local money being spent to keep things going. And it's the red states are kind of depopulating in a way. And as I said in the tweet today that, you know, in 50 years or so, we're all going to be living in 7 or 8 mega cities. And the rest of the country will be like some Stephen King dystopian future, you know. And to, you know, practice the kind of controlled agriculture, you probably don't want to be out where there's crops being grown.
Because you'll get poisoned.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, you know, we've been lied to for so long about Roundup, glyphosate, you know, and they're using more and more of it because the plants are developing a resistance to it. Because
unfortunately, humans aren't.
Monsanto had the patent for these GMO products, and they were designed to be used with Roundup. So, of course, you know, you're using one pesticide and one agricultural practice over and over. You're training the plants to the fittest to survive, and those genes are ferreted out, and pretty soon you got super weeds.
Well, I mean, that's just how evolution works. The theory that of the origins of agriculture that I learned, you know, a million years ago, and they're probably wrong, was that way back in time, once we got to be fully human and we were still hunter gatherers, we realized that some seeds were tasty when eaten. And so we humans would make baskets, and we'd walk through these waving fields of alfalfa. No, we'd walk through these waving fields, and we'd shake we'd shake the stalks and the seeds and collect the seeds that fell off, and then dry it and you know, get the chaff off the grain, and then, you know, make bread and beer and, you know, beer. And that those early humans unintentionally genetically preselected for grains that did not easily fall from the stalk.
Well, and you look at the progenitors of our modern corn. You know, it was basically just a like a row wheat, you know, row wheat, but it was...
No, it was grass. It's not even... It doesn't even remotely resemble maize. It was called teosinte, which I guess means grain of the gods or grass of the gods or something like that. But, you know, there was unintentional genetic preselection so that after a while, human beings had to stop doing that, and they had to actually go to the trouble of planting it, and boom, agriculture, sedentary society, and that's when life got a lot harder for human beings. We don't, most people don't realize that, but life was harder, is harder for sedentary agricultural societies than it was for hunter-gatherer societies.
Well, and hence the metaphor of Cain and Abel.
That's exactly what that is.
Yeah. And that, you know, even to this day, you know, you live in a rural area, the people that, you know, go out and get a deer, you know, and hunt and fish and stuff like that, you know, I forget the bumper sticker, but, you know, I'd rather be fishing, but I have to drive this truck and, you know, whatever, you know. But they, you know, it's true, even to this day, you know, people have this romanticized opinion of rural living and that. And if you like a lot of space between you and your neighbors, and, you know, you don't like big cities, I guess, you know, it's good for you. But I don't know. It's...
Well, you know, when I think about that image of the baskets and the seeds that fall easily, you know, I think about my dear friends up in Minnesota and northern Wisconsin.
Oh, the wild rice.
Yeah, and it's the same principle. But the fact of the matter is, it's a we're creating a world that isn't fit to live in. I wanted to take a moment and recommend something to people. I think you can get it at wvgazettemail.com, but you can get it easily at propublica.org. There's a new, if you want to learn, if you want to see where history and you know, journalism is just history that just happened. True journalism is just history that happened like a day or a week or a minute ago. It's history, because unless you're, you know, you can't really write about the future because it's unpredictable. So Ken Ward, who for years has labored in Charleston, West Virginia as a journalist with the Gazette, and is one of the single best sources on information and journalism regarding the coal industry in the world, okay? Ken just published an article through both the Gazette and ProPublica. Our buddy Dr. John put me onto this. I saw it early this morning. I encourage people to go and read this, because in a way this sort of dovetails clarity with what you were saying about eventually you're not going to want to live out there where they're spraying all the glyphosate. Well, a place like Appalachia, Central Appalachia, which is just perfectly suited to human habitation, because everything you need is here, and what was once upon a time an absolute embarrassing wealth of clean water.
Yeah, it's the whole state's a watershed.
Thin but rich soils. The place teemed with game once upon a time. I mean, it's hard to imagine a hardwood forest with a bunch of buffalo and elk running through it, but that's what it was. But the name of the article is, and it's a hell of a headline. Just look it up, propublica.org. The coal industry extracted a steep price from West Virginia. Now natural gas is leading the state down the same path. And it's both a retrospective on how West Virginia was basically to get all Old Testament again, since you worked the Cain and Abel side of the street, I'll work the Jacob and Isaac side of the street, Clarity. You remember the old story in Genesis about how Jacob, being jealous and not a very good person, defrauds his elder brother out of his birthright in exchange for a bowl for giving Isaac a bowl of shitty thin soup. Well, West Virginia traded its birthright away for a bowl of coal sludge, when you get right down to it. And Ken Ward documents the history of how Cole did it to West Virginia, and then with meticulous detail that is transferable to anywhere that is facing the ecological and so and social and cultural calamity of fracking, he makes it clear that it's happening. It's a hydrocarbon Groundhog Day here. And I really do. I recommend that people. I retweeted Ken's article earlier today on my Twitter feed, and I can't urge people enough to go and read this. I mean, it's chilling when you see a quote going all the way back to the earliest history of West Virginia as a state. When an early governor, I'm trying to find it here. Pointed out that we were just gonna get our clocks cleaned, and that it wasn't an accident. It's deja vu for the people who sat here 130 years ago and gave away our coal wealth to big out-of-state companies, said one state senator. That's what we're about to do again. And it's sort of, as it has ever been, so shall it always be. It was 65 years ago, 10 years before I was born, Ken Ward quotes then Governor William Marland. He'd grown up in the coal camps. He was the son of a mine superintendent. And he committed a heresy in this state in 1953 because he said he wanted to tax the coal industry to pay for schools and roads. And the coal industry had a fit. He was destroyed as a politician, but his words in 1953 sound like prophecy. Check this out. Let's use this equitable source of revenue because whether we like it or not, West Virginia's hills will be stripped, the bowels of the earth will be mined, and the refuse strewn across our valleys and our mountains in the form of burning slate dumps. Well, the state legislature soundly rejected him because they were owned lock, stock, and stinking barrel by the coal industry, and then it was over for Governor Marlin. It was just over.
Yeah, well, they're in Oregon here. They're trying to paint Kate Brown as, you know, the most radical governor in the United States, and there's six Republicans running against her. And I actually got a attack call from one GOP candidate attacking another GOP candidate. And I guess the worst slam you can give a Republican is that they're just Hillary Light. You know, you're just not conservative enough. And what was the other thing that this... guy was calling the other guy for his bona fides. But, you know, they're saying that we need a real conservative, not a Hillary Light trying to work from the middle. That's a mistake we've had for four terms. The right Democrats, the leftist, radical left Democrats have been running Oregon, and we need to put an end to this now. And they're trying to peel off some of the state workers because she put a surtax on their medical benefits, which becomes a payroll deduction. And to keep the Oregon health plan solvent, because we talked about this last week, but I thought it was interesting that the way the Republicans attack each other, and then we, you know, call the DCC out on, you know, what they did in Arizona this morning on.
And now the story that's coming out of Colorado with what they're doing in one district in near Denver.
Well, maybe it was Colorado. They played the interview.
Denny Hoyer, and the candidate's name is Tilleman.
Yeah, and that they dropped all their dimes on the other guy because he's a corporate Dem, and not progressive in the least. And he was not Medicare for all. It seems like the DCC does not want that on the platform.
Well, you know, I try to be, and I'm not disagreeing with you, Clarity. I try to look at these things from an analytical standpoint. And in modern American politics, everything is driven by focus groups and polling data. And if it's just a matter of they're always going to default to the corporatist because corporatism, then we're super duper horrible fucked. Because
yeah,
that means that no matter that the will of the people is absolutely not mattering.
Could substitute the word neoliberal.
On the other hand, though, this particular district was carried by Hillary in 16. It was carried by Barack Obama. And yet the Republican incumbent has continued to win in that environment. I mean, he's not some noob. So the calculus is probably we've got to have a candidate who is tailored, and it is a suburban Denver district, and I take that to mean that it is probably gerrymandered to be whiter than Tom Sawyer's fence.
It's a swing district, they call it. Yeah. Yeah, that's the way the third district is in Washington.
And so it could very well be that it's got a lot of people in it who have health care, so fuck everybody who doesn't. And it could be, a middle-class so-called district where people aren't worried about where their next meal's coming from. And it's a middle-class, mostly white district, so they're not worried about the plight of immigrants. In other words, they're not very interested in progressive issues as they have been defined in the recent past.
No, somehow we've painted Medicare as, you know, being some sort of dependency that if, you know, you would have did better financial planning and, you know, just whatever, you know, blame the person.
Right,
who,
you know, well, if God liked you better, it's just neo-Calvinism. If God liked you better, you wouldn't be in the spot you're in.
Yeah. And it seems like that even people that I would think would be more compassionate about it, nurses included, of course, nurses tend to be more conservative, that universal health care is not something that's important to United States. And, you know, I don't know why we're so afraid of it. You know, what I hear sometimes in conservative circles is we just don't want to, you know, in Europe, you can't do anything without, you know, there's no freedom in Europe. And that's what you pay off. And you pay twice as much in taxes and, you know, and we got a woman here who's from Germany. And when they first worked out Trump, the Affordable Care Act, she was going, well, if this passes, you know, you won't be able to get dialysis after 55 because that's where they draw the line in Germany, and it's going to be just like Germany. And I was just amazed that, you know, somebody would say something like that, but that's how
Well,
right from the,
you know, no culture is monolithic. I heard something similar to that from a, you know, from a German who said, you know, I'm getting taxed to death in Germany. And I said, yeah, but you got health care. You've got a functioning culture. And he said, yeah, but I think I could come over here and do a lot better for myself. And my response was, well, yeah, you could as long as everything's okay. But if anything goes sideways, pal, you're fucked.
Yeah, and he would be because he wasn't a resident, you know. You'd have to get a citizenship to get any of the quote-unquote rights of a U.S. citizen. I mean, if he came over here and tried to get a job, they might not want to hire him.
I think he could probably get a job because they would know that he's probably good at what he does.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm just
saying. But the exigencies of life in a country that despises the concept of a social safety net, and that's not to say that horrible damage hasn't been done over the years to the German social safety net. It is not what it once was.
No, and in a way, Canada's has been chiseled away.
And you know, we had our little Gallic-gasm this week over Emmanuel Macron. But if you check in with the French working class, they wouldn't pee on him if he was on fire.
Yeah,
because he's going after trade unions. He's going after. He's going after the social safety net. You could argue that he's behaving like a Republican.
Well,
you know,
that's old school
Republican.
That's what the industrialists want. They don't want people speaking up for their, you know, rights to have a living wage and not be wage slaves. And somehow we haven't got that message in this country. It's like, oh, well, let's work three jobs. And it's like, well, all you're doing is working. You don't have any civic life. You know, you don't have time to enjoy the arts. You don't have time for recreation.
Right, but what you're talking about there, Clarity, is the Porsche gap.
Yeah.
Because, see, if there's a middle class that can go to the lake on the weekend, if there's a middle class that can put their kids through college, if there's a middle class that can retire with dignity and not sweat dinner every week versus being able to buy their prescription medications, well, that means that the 1% gets less Porsches.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. That is intolerable.
Oh, it's ugly. It's what is going on, the gap and the amount of unnecessary misery and suffering in this country. You know, even the people that are working are not getting a fair shot on the deal.
I mean, just as and this is sort of off topic, but as you click around the television someday, pay attention to what gets advertised on which channels. And this is part of the longer speech about how for-profit broadcasting has nothing to do with delivering anything to the viewer or listener, and everything to do with delivering those listeners and viewers to the tender mercies of merchants of some form or another. But if you pay attention, you know, based on what you're watching, see what's getting advertised in those slots. See who's trying to be driven where. For instance, I remember years and years and years ago, you'd tune into Meet the Press back before there was an MSNBC, or you'd tune into CBS CBS Sunday Morning, and you'd see two or three ads for Archer Daniels Midland.
Yeah.
Right, what the hell are they going to sell you?
Well, you couldn't buy anything from them if you tried. You can't go. You can't go buy a bag of Archer Daniels Midland beans.
Right.
There's no Archer Daniels Midland rice. There's no shiny new Archer Daniels Midland family crapmobile.
They just wanted
they
to
were
be accepted.
They weren't advertising to you and me and us.
No.
They were advertising. They were advertising to the policymakers who get up bleary-eyed on Sunday morning, hung over to the point that they're ready to puke up their fucking toenails and watch and watch, you know, policy wonk TV. That's who they were advertising to.
They're controlling the content. It's an attempt on their part to control the content.
Exactly, Steve. It influences it. The other side of it is, that filthy habit I have in the morning. I noticed one day that there were some ads running, and I saw it some other places too, for a Cadillac that'll drive itself out on the highway. And it kind of blew my mind that... okay, cool, self-driving car, meet George Jetson. But in the imagery they used, they showed the guy, and it was a guy in his Cadillac sedan, that the sedan was driving itself. I'm sorry, Hal. I'm sorry, Dave. But he's got a bottle in his hand. Okay, well, I've got a bottle in my hand right now of... caffeine-free diet Pepsi. Shit'll kill you, Bob. Don't send me the emails.
Now, when you say a bottle, you mean a bottle of Jack Daniel's?
Green glass bottle. It looks like a bottle of Heineken or Moosehead with the label off of it.
So the message is, you can get hammered and drive. Man, that'll turn industry as we know it on its head, won't it?
It was subliminal. Wow. It was subliminal as hell. But right. Then again, it's on a car that costs $90,000 fucking dollars. So if you can buy a $90,000 car with a self-driving function, you can probably afford the cost of getting pulled over. You know, hammered out of your brains on some highway running along the coastal cliffs of Maine.
Or just that you'll subliminally infer that the Cadillac definitely drives better than a drunk. At least it drives better than a drunk.
But that's being, you know, that car... There's no, oddly enough, there's no ads out there for the 2019 Kia shitbox with its self-driving software. So what the message is with technology like that is that, you know, we're going to put it in the cars for the people. We're going to put this stuff in the cars and all the safety features. We're going to put it in the cars for the people who deserve to be safe, who can afford to be safe. And the rest of y'all just take your chances, okay?
Well, if you live in Argentina or South America, some of those countries, they build Chevys and stuff that don't have airbags,
Yeah. Mexico continued to manufacture and sell the old school, you know, with the rear engine and the air cooled, you know, little boxer, they manufactured that thing for a long time after that vehicle quit being sold in the United States.
Which begs the question, Bob, if you are to consume that mystery bottle of whatever it is, and you're hammered, and the computer malfunctions, who is culpable?
GM.
Wrap your head around that a minute, you know?
Ralph Nader. Ralph did it. Well, and that green bottle could be a bottle of cannabis something or other, too. They have beverages now.
Are you out there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm just carrying on an off-air conversation with my daughter.
No.
Say hi, daughter.
Rick.
See? She's really here.
Hello there.
Hello there. Yes, this is the indomitable Lili.
You got youngins around.
Yes.
Huh?
Well, this is the eldest of the youngins, and she done come to see the old folks tonight. Because, you know, she heard my lumbago was acting up, and I had me a mustard plaster.
And I lost my tooth.
And tell her, Bob, about my butt probe that's coming up.
No. And the monitors aren't on, so she didn't hear that.
Oh, Grandpa's got some headphones on. We're on mute in the studio.
There's no key if I set a spell here on the porch.
Wait a minute. Lorelei has a contribution. Do it. You got to do it.
Oh, my thyroid.
Oh. Yeah, see? Yeah.
I'm done.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent.
Go away. I do not like your hat.
Not like your hat.
Okay. She just came in and tapped me on my shoulder and about jumped 15 feet in the air.
Is that your granddaughter?
No, it's my daughter. It's my daughter.
Oh, okay.
Our eldest. Right. But I'm used to working back here by myself, and she deliberately did that whole the fog creeps in on little cat feet thing, and I didn't hear anything because I had my cans on. And I was like, "Whoo, Godfrey Daniel, mother of pearl." So that was the silence. There was me checking in with the baby.
I was just curious, and I'd like to get a legal mind in on this.
Well,
in
we haven't heard from Billable Rick, so this would be a lovely time.
He's out there, but he must be doing billable things right now.
Is he?
Tonight.
Oh, by the way, Brother Deacon Asa informs us, Emmanuel Macron is very much a right winger. He's polling at Trump levels over there in France. And,
He seems sane. That's Trump.
Asa says, back in the 80s in the old country, we used to take seat belts out of cars. It was considered useless junk that didn't need to be there. I'm not kidding.
No, he's not.
No.
In fact, they weren't even convenient. I remember my 72 Impala, they were folded up above where the window was.
Well, that was the shoulder harness.
Right.
They were separate pieces, and the buckles, the catches were two separate items, and you had to get one and then you had to pull down the other.
That's right.
And along the way, you know, it's been a lot of trial and error. For a time there, GM was using these things that they called wound up being called window shade seat belts. You remember these? Like on an Oldsmobile Cutlass or a Pontiac Grand Prix, you'd open the door and the seatbelt would extend as the door opened so that when you got in, the seatbelt was just around you. Well, there was only one problem with that. If you got hit hard enough from the side or took an impact to the side in a situation like where the car would roll, well, the door would open and you'd fly out, and that seatbelt didn't do shit for you. and a whole bunch of people got all dead real fast.
Now, is that like the Ultima seatbelt where you got in and it automatically buckled you in? Do you remember that?
Yeah,
went the way of the Tony Bear too.
Yeah, because it was dangerous.
Yeah.
I owned a Saturn that when you open the door, it would actually go back and forth. Like there's heart and a harness. The shoulder harness would go back and forth on the track on the car.
Oh, yeah, it was motorized. I remember that. In its disengaged position, it was toward the dashboard, and then it would...
Right. You'd have to put your lap belt on. You'd strap your lap belt on from the bottom. That was when the Saturn, that plastic car they used to sell, GM used to have it. It was the Saturn SL2 is what I had.
And we had a 1974 Dodge Monaco Brome station wagon with a 440 cubic inch 4-barrel engine in it. Damn, that was a beast. It may have looked like a family car, but that I could ruin a pair of tires on one good Saturday night, or a set of tires, a pair, on the rear wheel drive. But that thing had the seats on it were wonderful. They were vinyl, but they were like bark-a-loungers. But that thing was set up in such a way that if the seat belt was not buckled, the car would not start.
Really?
Yeah. Now, it only took us a year or so to realize that what you had to do is you took the lap belt and you took the center, because it was three people across the front, and it only applied to the driver. So all you had to do was take the center lap belt and plug it in and snap it into the driver's side safety belt, and it would start. As it turned out, it was a pretty handy theft deterrent. Because if you didn't drive the car, you didn't know the trick. But this was also the same American-made vehicle that if you drove through, a water puddle where the water goes, you know, off your fenders. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd lose the ability to steer the automobile. You'd just kind of have to gently roll forward until the steering decided to come back. It was, but man, when I was a teenager, we used to roll around, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 people in that car.
Hmm. Probably with room to spare, too.
Yeah, and that 440, that 444 barrel would take you the 11 miles from Florence, Alabama to the Tennessee state line to get beer. In about 7 minutes. I begged for the 8-track tape player, but my dad wasn't having any of it. So we got one of those portable 8-track tape players from Sears that had the separatable speakers. And I can remember driving to the Tennessee state line, listening to Jerry Reed singing, "Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. We gonna do what they say can't be done. We got a long way to go and a short time to get there." No more singing.
My mom and dad had an 84 two-door Monte Carlo, and it had an 8-track. And I can remember them playing the best of the Eagles at the time.
There are Eagles songs that if I hear them today, I hear the silent space where it's changing channels. Whoa, whoa, you got the best of my love. Yeah. Anyway,
it's funny how back then that was when radio, that's when they made a majority of their money, is when it came back to the, you know, old classic rock radio is what made them have all their money.
Now you got me curious. I got to look up. Let's see.
I'm sorry.
No. Let's see. Best of the Eagles 8-track.
I mean, I can remember it. It was an 8-track and it had like a skeleton on it.
Yeah, the cow skull.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Stairway to Heaven faded in and out too.
And the thing is, some of them would fade it in and fade it out, and others it was just a blunt cut, just.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, I think we have Rick with us now. Billable Rick, you there? Well, he just sent me a text. Well,
I just saw him on there. Did he jump off?
I was right. Segment C3 is Best of My Love, and say, whoa, sweet darling, you get the best of my love. Yeah, it was C3 to D1. The other one, now B3 managed to take it to the limit all the way onto that portion, and then C1 opened with Tequila Sunrise. The other one, though, there's great Eagles tunes out there, some would argue. The one that, Jackson Brown actually wrote Already Gone. And that was one of the more rockin' tunes on the tape. And so, and I'm already
gone. Wow, you're bringing back my childhood, Bob.
Do you remember when your A-track got really raggedy and you could hear two songs at once?
Trey, can you still hear the when it comes on the radio?
Yes, I can. That's crazy. That's crazy what that stuff does to you.
I'm sorry, Steve. I didn't mean to run over you, buddy.
No, that's okay, friend. No, that's okay. Do you remember when your 8-track got old and raggedy, you could hear two songs playing at the same time?
Oh, yeah. And no amount of 8-track head cleaner would fix that. It was just the game was over.
I've always been obsessed with the whole 8-track thing.
Was that the heads or was that the tape wearing out?
I think the head was positioned in the wrong place, or it could have been the tape. You know, who knows?
It was annoying as shit, I can tell you that. And you know, then later on, we moved into the realm of cassette decks. And, you know, cassette decks...
You had to put a matchbook in.
Yeah, cassette decks stayed viable up into the late 90s, early 2000s. But this is one of those fun little young stoner stories. Little Timmy, little Cindy, leave the room. It's
all right, get out of here, guys. Go on, kids, go. They're gone. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh my God, there really is a little Timmy and a little Cindy to run out of the room tonight.
Come on, get out of here. He's not. No, just go on, guys. Go on. Go ahead, Bob.
So what? But once upon a time in my misspent youth. So there was a cassette deck in the car, which meant you had to carry a cassette deck head cleaner, right?
Oh yeah, it was necessary.
And the good ones, you know, they had that little bottle of fluid that you put on the pad so that it would really get all the old oxide off the heads, and you'd get
and a demagnetizer too.
Absolutely. And so
did you just say get off the little pad for the heads?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pastor, I bet you could still order that on Prime.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yep, and then the damn pad would wear out on the cassette.
Yeah, cuz you got to have you buy a new ones. So, we were at a party one night. And you know, the nice thing about this is it's a cross between Kentucky bluegrass and California Sentimental. You can play 18 holes and then get stoned to the bejesus belt. Well, we were stoned to the bejesus belt, and I had to worry about coming home with my eyes looking like a Rand McNally atlas. Because being a blue-eyed person, I'm susceptible to getting red-eyed when I'm, you know, honking away on a doobie. Or was.
Steve's laugh. I think that's really cool.
Oh, it's a great laugh. I mean, there are comedians out there who will pay for Steve's laugh, okay? So I was all stoned and I'd gone to the restroom and I looked in the mirror and, oh man, you know, it was just little red lines running through the white, you know, all over. And the blue just made it look positively patriotic. And I reached in my left hand jeans pocket for my bottle of Clear Eyes, which I always carried with me because it worked better than anything else. Visine, fuck that. That's just branch water. But Clear Eyes, well, that worked. And I remembered, no, it's not. Okay, it's out in the car. I'd put it in the glove compartment. And so with the lights not on and the light was, for some reason, out in that Chrysler sedan, I got in the passenger side of my car, opened up the glove box without thinking, because again, stoned, reached in, grabbed the little plastic bottle, took the lid off it, you know, pulled my eyelid back and went, derp,
oh,
derp,
no.
Derp, and it was head cleaning fluid.
It was pure alcohol.
Pure alcohol right in my eyeball.
Isopropyl.
You might as well.
Ouch.
Oh my God!
Oh, it burned, and you know if I'd had contacts, it would have welded it to my eyeball.
That's before 911. What the hell did you do?
Oh, I ran back in and just, you know, was splashing water in my eye, trying to, because at that point in time I didn't care who but of course I also took time to find the bottle of Clear Eyes and, you know, did the left eye at least so that, you know, I kind of had that one good eye thing going on. Because then you can make the argument, oh, no, I got, you know, we were playing ping pong, and I took a ping pong in the right eye, Mom.
That's like the time when I was a small child. My mother and father both smoked cigarettes, and I can remember there was a Coke can sitting, and I went to take a drink, and it was nothing but cigarette ashes and butts. One of the most dramatic experiences of my life. If like then on, I was like, I will never smoke again. All I wanted was a Coke, and I got ashes and butts and whatever else that I just drank.
That's right up there with a big drink of bong water.
Yeah, there you go.
And we've probably all done that.
I just did that recently, Bob, so don't be mad at me.
Well, no, I understand. Yeah.
Well, I've missed all these experiences because I've lived a very sheltered life.
Yeah, but Larry, when you decide to let go, Katie, bar the door.
Yeah, look out if you let go.
By the way, I wanted to say before I'm sorry to hear that your knee's not in great shape, Duncan. I hope that whatever they can do to help. And I'm sorry to hear about your tooth, Bob. I didn't know about your tooth. I don't know what happened with your tooth.
No, it just shattered all to hell.
Ouch. I'm sorry to hear that. And I've really enjoyed the conversation that you've had with Clarity. It kind of, the conversation kind of reinforced all the things that I've already believed. I didn't necessarily, I learned little nuances on my beliefs every time I hear other people talk about the same subject and, you know, the way in which they come at it. But I really enjoyed that. I don't know who the governor is in Oregon that you're talking about, Clarity, or, you know, but we have friends up in Oregon. We have Grant Gibson in Portland and a few other people. But I don't know who you're talking about. Is she really all that weird or are they just painting her that way? I don't know if Clarity's still around, but
she's actually center left.
Yeah, well, the right wing is getting away. You know, they can get away with painting people with all kinds of labels because it's been so long since we've had anyone who's been remotely left in either, you know, in the Democratic Party.
Well, I mean, yeah. Look, Larry. I mean, you know all you need to know about the right wing when you consider that it is considered a legitimate topic of conversation in the right wing to refer to Adolf Hitler as a socialist.
Yeah.
And that's been going on for 18 years.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking here at some books that I got. I got some used copies of some editions of some books by professors who were writing in the late 60s and early 70s about how conservative that the society was, and brought up some of the same arguments that Steve and Clarity and you were talking about earlier about corporate control and about corporate control of the environment and stuff. And the same kind of arguments that particular governor back in the 50s in West Virginia was, you know, mentioned. And they were writing this stuff in the late 60s and early 70s. And we need these people more now than we needed them then. It's worse now. And these kinds of writers are nowhere to be found. Whereas you could, back in the 60s and early 70s, perhaps have someone who was a democratic socialist be considered to be a viable, or I don't know what the appropriate word I'm trying to think right now in my head, they would be considered to be viable in any panel discussion, and they would be taken, you know, at least somewhat seriously. But you can't find these people anymore. You just can't. But there were people talking about the same stuff that you and Clarity and Steve were talking about earlier. There were academics that were writing this stuff in the late 60s and early 70s. So I don't know where we were or why we're so out of it now. Anyway.
Ronnie Reagan.
Yeah, it's been in stages. But like the Civil War started, you know, in the 1840s with the Know-Nothings, and people who, you know, considered the, you know, kept saying, well, I'm not an abolitionist, but yeah, slavery is a bad thing, you know, and, you know, it was bounced around. It's hard to imagine people, you know, debating whether it's okay to enslave another human being. And I think now, as what's going on now, there's kind of a voluntary slavery going on with, you know, the corporate people. Some of their workers, they're paying pretty good money, but you know, it's $17 an hour is the kind of the baseline for a living wage, and where is it? $7.
Well, one of the points of the conversation that you were talking about, the industrial base or the economic base of the country, Clarity, and I kind of defocused there for a little while, but you were kind of trying to explain that eventually what the future is going to mean for the rural, I missed some of your argument, but what I find is that it's difficult for me to be part of a minority. I don't necessarily like the majority culture, if you understand, Bob. I don't necessarily like the way in which the social and the economic structure has played itself out in this society. But I also feel frustrated.
Great heavenly days, I don't either. But
I feel frustrated that I'm part of a minority that seems to be, you know, we seem to be backed up here on the, you know, in a little place called Berkeley, California, and, you know, in certain pockets on the West Coast, and we can't get a majority. You know, we're not taken seriously either. So I'm angry at the majority culture, but I'm frustrated that I'm part of a minority, if you can understand what I'm saying.
It is not the same, but I, you know, based on the stuff that I work on, believe you me, I understand. It's that whole concept of not herding cats, but wrangling butterflies.
Oh yeah, we have it here. We have not that I'm involved very much, but we have situations where you have different left groups that wrangle amongst each other, and they can't agree. They decide to disagree about little tiny topics that have very little. They split hairs, you know.
Yeah.
About left wing topics.
The reason that scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian is so damned funny. You know, the one where they're talking about the People's Judean Front and the People's Front of Judea, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Judea, and the Judean Liberation Front. They all ostensibly have the same aim, but they're so busy picking at each other that they can never accomplish any of their stated goals, and you know, splitters. And that's the curse of any marginalized group, Larry. The challenge of trying to find a way to speak with one voice.
Well,
kind of like the question I always have is, why in the world in 2018 there's a chaplain in our Congress? Can someone help me out with that?
No, say I got nothing.
Oh, Bob, where can I get? Remember, you were talking about the journalist from the WB Gazette.
No, WV, West Virginia.
West Virginia Gazette. I'm sorry, must be my ear.
No, it's probably my mouth.
But where can I get that that article? Because
probably the easiest thing to do is go to ProPublica.org.
Okay. I know that group because I know nothing about the history. I know nothing about the history of how the coal industry started, what the structure of it was, the history, the structure, how it developed the way that it did, and what kind of effects that it has on the, you know, what kind of you know, what, you know, the political aspects and all that stuff. I have no idea about any of that. I really don't know anything at all. The only thing I know is that I wanted to see the ACAC passed.
Well, it's you know, we continue to work on that, and we'll be ready to hit the ground running in January 2019.
Okay.
And get it well, because it's been introduced in every Congress since 2012.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We've tried for 6 years now. Yeah. But I'm sorry to hear that your tooth was bothering you, and I'm sorry to hear, Duncan, that your leg is. How did you get the knee? I know you've had it. Was it a work injury or a war injury, or what happened there? I mean, is Duncan
Larry? I twisted my knee getting in my parents' car on Thanksgiving in 1971 in their garage, and I tore my meniscus in my left medial meniscus, which is your inside meniscus, on my left knee. And then I had surgeries, and then I had 40 years of being an electrician, too, working. You got to spend a lot of time on your knees.
A lot of time crawling around, right, Sparky?
Well, think of all the outlets in your house.
Yeah.
Put it down low. You can't put them in standing up.
No, you
can't.
And
you didn't wear knee pads either, did you? No, back then we didn't have any sense at all, man.
No, well, I started
going with San Francisco slippers back in the 80s.
And
San Francisco slippers.
Yeah, help me.
That was the nickname for knee pads back then. It started back in the 80s.
Ah,
oh, okay.
Okay, okay.
Larry,
all the gays were in San Francisco, okay?
Okay. So does that take some of the pressure off your knee when you're bending down on your?
What, a knee pad?
Yeah.
Well, it's a cushion instead of having a hard surface against your knee. Concrete. Okay. Kneel down on concrete for day after day. It gets to you real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the story I told of they called him Big Daddy, who founded Dreamland Barbecue down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He was a concrete finisher. And he was down on his knees working on a job, and legend has it that he looked up and said, "God, don't let me spend the rest of my life on my knees."
Well, he was probably using some skids.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, we're talking about Big Daddy John Bishop. 1958 is when he founded it.
So Bob, where can I get a history of the whole shebang of West Virginia and the coal industry, or where can I read stuff? And because I don't really know anything.
There are several good books. Jeff Charlotte wrote one. As for an overall, you know, an overall history, Jeff Bigger's book, The United States of Appalachia, is a good start.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And he wrote one about coal in the place in southern Illinois where he grew up called Reckoning at Eagle Creek. But it's not something. I'm racking my mind. I'm trying to think if there's, you know, just one good book that covers it all. But there's really not. If you want some fairly intimate history, Night Comes to the Cumberlands.
Oh, I have that book somewhere in my
by Harry Caudill.
In my house.
Yeah. It'll. Yeah. I mean, it. And it's very, very Kentucky specific, but a lot of it's transferable. There are, and you know, so it's a history that's hard to tell in a way, because nobody likes to just, you know, even Hamlet, where everybody dies in the end, has some laughter along the way. The history of coal in the United States doesn't have that. It is just it's one long narrative
of crap,
of abuse and oppression, murder,
yeah,
disease, death, poverty.
Is it like what's the bury my heart at wounded?
Kinda, yeah. There's a book by Lon Savage called Thunder in the Mountains. That is good.
Well, I wanna tell you that a few days ago, I haven't gotten a chance to really say what's been going on with myself, but a couple of days ago, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz came and spoke about her book, where she goes through the origins of how the Second Amendment was birthed and how it came about, and the actual how the NRA actually was started and what it was started in order to do, and how it's changed its focus with the right wing taking it over, and how it used to be a requirement that the colonies made it a requirement for the farmers to carry a weapon. And then eventually it became a federal amendment to the Constitution after it was a requirement for these farmers to have the weapons, because the farmers wanted to have the ability to take land and they wanted to have the ability to kill Native Americans. So that was part of the whole thing around people feeling that they had the entitlement to have a gun. I don't know if that's your understanding or if that's Dr. Bob's understanding.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, Larry, because remember, there's a reference in the Declaration of Independence to George III inciting the merciless heathen savages to attack poor, innocent white settlers who hadn't done anything except stolen a bunch of land. Against the against the very strict orders and treaties of the crown. And so whether it's Western New York or Western Massachusetts or Kentucky, there was a desire to maintain militias. And the other part of it is that the militias, the state militias, were seen as a buffer, just in case the federal government, that not everybody was real keen on having in the first place, ever decided to get all froggy and try to put down rebellions by a state against the federal government. That whole NRA paranoid raving about how, well, you know, we got to have ourselves AR-15s because one of these days the jackbooted government might come along and try to put their jackbooted jackboots down on our freedom-loving necks right next to the tattoo that says only God can judge me. That's got a long history in this country. And in point of fact, I think you might find this interesting. At the time, you know, everybody knows that stupid, 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 stupid quote from Thomas Jefferson all about how the tree of liberty must be watered from time to time with the blood of tyrants and patriots. It is its natural manure. Okay, everybody's heard that. Nobody knows what the background is on that. He wrote that in a letter at a time when a rebellion was taking place in the state of Massachusetts, in which people like his old pal John Adams felt pretty sure that they were just going to come and slit his throat in the night. And Jefferson's response to the concerns of his old buddy was, well, you know, if you got it coming, John, you got it coming. Good on him. And then I get, awesome. And then he probably put down his pen and went and raped Sally for a while.
Well, Bob, you know, she also talked about the people that were carrying the guns. They also had slave patrols, and the slave patrols eventually became the police. So the police, so the history of the development of police departments comes directly from these so-called militias, and eventually, you know, which a lot of people in the South apparently know this. I haven't verified it, but a lot of the people that wore the sheets came out of police departments.
Well, there is not, to my understanding, there is not historical consensus on the slave aspect of the Second Amendment. For instance, if you and one of the people who contributed to a great deal of misunderstanding was Tom Hartman. Tom wrote an article a while back claiming that nearly the entire reason for the Second Amendment was slavery and slave patrols. And it comes across as being very convincing because, of course, everything that Tom writes, he writes as though, you know, he is the final word and the absolute authority on the topic. But what's interesting is not too long after he published that article, somebody who really, really was an authority on the topic and knew the history upside down, backwards, forwards, and sideways, published an article that said, this is just flat wrong, okay? And like you mentioned, police departments. Well, the first police department in the United States was not in a slave state. The first police department in the United States was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So I think there's probably, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. The Klan was obviously a vigilante group that was set up to run a post-war insurgency against the enactment of federal government policy regarding freedom of former slaves. It was a treasonous insurgency, the purpose of which was to make sure that any gains that freed slaves got through the Freedmen's Bureau and Reconstruction were rendered moot and meaningless by violence. You want to compare it to something? Look at what happened after George Bush's Iraq War, with the insurgency that started up, and the way that Baathists, Shia tried to put down the Baathists, and the Baathists tried to put down the Shia, and they bombed each other's mosques and so forth. That's comparable, except for the fact that in the case of post Civil War America, the freed former slaves had no access to or recourse to countering the Klan. It's not like there were people running around in the night burning down white folks' houses too, and lynching white people.
Well, that's very interesting. But that's very interesting. I just want to let you know that I did go to see. I know you know that Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz wrote the Indigenous History of Indigenous American.
Absolutely, and I mean she's a scholar.
You know, and she's and also this weekend we're having a book fair in Berkeley. So what's going to happen is all over Berkeley there are going to be authors that are going to be on panels in different, you know, on different topics. Some of them are going to be some of these authors are going to be part of panels that are going to be discussing issues, and some of the panels are going to be moderated, and some are going to be interviews of particular authors. So I've got, so I'm going to try to get out to some of those. There are going to be a lot of them, 10 to 6 in Berkeley on Saturday and Sunday. I know that, you know, I'm just letting you know what's happening. And other than that, my father had a scare, but he's getting care now, and we got to watch him now. In addition, What else is going on? I'm struggling my way through Algebra 2, which is intermediate high school algebra, and I'm struggling my way through it, but I'm trying.
You have my complete and undying sympathy.
Well, I'm, you know, you had to go through it, and everyone else, and I know Dunk probably had to know that, had to know math for electronics, and I, you know, a lot of you have to know all that. So my father was asking.
Why in the world are you taking Algebra 2, Larry?
Are you a masochist, Larry?
Because I just feel that that's part of.
You'll never apply it to anything, bro.
No, ever. But hold on, guys. Hold on.
Algebra can be quite practical, actually.
Yeah, hold on a minute. I'm the English major. I don't do math well. But don't just sit here and poo-poo Larry's desire to learn an essential component of a liberal arts education. You know, liberal arts isn't just sitting around and reading fucking Keats and Shakespeare. It's knowing the maths and the sciences.
I've never applied it to anything. Just from my own personal experience.
So am I just torturing myself for no reason?
It shouldn't be a deal breaker.
Make sure you carry the one.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Larry, don't listen to anyone else. Do what you want to do, man.
Do what you want to do, bro.
Yeah, it opens up a horizon. You know, if you can conquer Algebra 2, onward to trig, baby.
Yeah. True.
And then before you know it, you'll be a calculus whiz, Larry.
Yes. And quantum.
Brian,
I got a C in calculus.
And then quantum physics, you can really expand your mind, you know?
And before you know it, you're going to be like a new Stephen Hawking now, Larry.
Yeah, how's Brian doing, Rick? Is he doing okay?
Yeah, he's doing great. He's taking calculus right now. He was on the phone with me. My microphone wasn't working,
see?
That's why I couldn't weigh in. But he was trying to challenge some of the answers to a multiple choice quiz that he got wrong in environmental sciences. One of the questions had to do with what is the main contributor to increase in sea level rise, and the main two options that he was focused on, he basically chose the melting of sea ice as the main one, and the professor said that the correct answer was the thermal expansion of water due to increasing temperatures. And Brian found a study that shows that his answer is the correct one. So he's sort of like, you know, he's kind of pissed off that he got, you know, some of these questions wrong, supposedly. So,
if
you take the total volume of water on Earth that's not frozen, there is a lot of expansion, though, compared to what's melted and added to that volume of water.
Yeah, well, he found a 1993 Columbia University study, so maybe that's dated. Maybe that's not accurate anymore.
For anybody who wants a really good laugh along these lines, this has been going around on. I mean, this goes back to fax machines and ditto things. It's been around forever. I mean, I think Snopes has even analyzed it. But look up: is hell exothermic or endothermic? You will laugh.
Well, Rick, my question is, did the instructor deal with Brian with empathy and compassion, or did he just slam Brian upside down and down the other?
He basically said, hey, I didn't create this test, someone else did, so they must be right, was sort of his response. And Brian didn't know what to say because he didn't have any evidence to arm himself with. But another question had to do with whether the what is something that would not be associated with global warming? And it was basically between an increase in insect problems, you know, like infectious diseases caused by insects, or a cooling of the North Atlantic near Great Britain. And the correct answer was supposedly that you would not associate with, or wait, which one of the following is not associated with global warming. It would be a cooling of the North Atlantic near Great Britain, and that has to do with the decrease in the Gulf Stream, which basically warms the waters off of Great Britain and warms the North Atlantic. But that assumption wasn't stated in the question. So anyway, it's sort of, you know, geeky stuff, but you know, at least Brian is assertive enough to challenge authority, you know, which is good. Yeah. So I'm proud of him for that, you know.
Well, the subliminal message is, you know, consensus. You know, get in line, right. Believe what everybody else believes, even though, you know, you know in your gut that it's wrong, but you don't want to have them all pointing their fingers at you and going, heretic.
Well, at least my son is not a climate change denier, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Clarity, where in Oregon are you located?
I'm in the desert northeast, near the Washington border. Near the Washington border, about 3 hours east of Portland on Interstate 84.
Because my brother had a place in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, that's 3 hours away south.
Yeah, so
yeah,
he did. He doesn't have it now. But the three books that you were suggesting, Bob, are the Jeff Biggers,
Thunder in the Mountains, Night Comes to the Cumberlands, and United States of Appalachia.
Yeah. Okay.
If you get your head around all those, all three of those, you'll be well on your way. I mentioned that bit. I'm going to go ahead and share it just because it's so damn funny. The setup to this, and like I said, it's been around for eons, is that it's either a physics or a chemistry exam in college. It's one of those eccentric professor exams where there's only one question on the final. The question is hell exothermic, gives off heat, or endothermic, absorbs heat?
Hell isn't real, period.
Well, okay, but you're no fun. So the student answers thusly. First, we need to know how the mass of hell is changing in time. So we need to know the rate at which souls are moving into hell and the rate at which they're leaving, which is unlikely. I think that we can safely assume that once a soul gets to hell, it will not leave. Therefore, no souls are leaving. As for how many souls are entering hell, let's look at the different religions that exist in the world today. Most of these religions state that if you are not a member of their religion, you will go to hell. Since there is more than one of these religions, and since people do not belong to more than one religion, we can project that all souls go to hell. With birth and death rates as they are, we can expect the number of souls in hell to increase exponentially. Now, we look at the rate of change of the volume in hell, because Boyle's law states that in order for the temperature and pressure in hell to stay the same, the volume of hell has to expand proportionately as souls are added. This gives two possibilities. If hell is expanding at a slower rate than the rate at which souls enter hell, then the temperature and pressure in hell will increase until all hell breaks loose. If hell is expanding at a rate faster than the increase of souls in hell, then the temperature and pressure will drop until hell freezes over. So, which is it? If we accept the postulate given to me by Teresa during my freshman year that it will be a cold day in hell before I sleep with you, and take into account the fact that I slept with her last night, then number two must be true, and thus I am sure that hell is exothermic and has already frozen over. The corollary of this theory is that since hell has frozen over, it follows that it is not accepting any more souls and is therefore extinct, leaving only heaven, thereby proving the existence of a divine being, which explains why last night Teresa kept shouting, "Oh my God." The student got
an A. Aren't you happy you studied argumentation?
I love that bit.
That is great. Where'd you get that from, Bob?
Just look up, is hell exothermic or endothermic?
Oh, okay. Exo or endothermic. Okay,
yeah, I'm ashamed of the fact that my brain has hung on to that, but it's just cute.
Hey,
is actually a nuclear bomb.
There you go. Hey, I wanted to add somebody to the list of concerts to see.
Yes?
But I don't know if I want to plunk my money down to see him.
Do you really?
How about Shania Twain? Apparently she would have voted
for
Trump.
Yeah, go see her.
Well, that'll be fun.
Maybe I should see her. And maybe I can use my special powers. Although I don't want to do that to a girl.
Stay away from Fleetwood Mac. I don't want to see anything happen to Stevie Nicks up on her walker.
What do you mean?
Or Kansas. Don't go see Kansas, by God. Don't.
No, why? Because they became born again Christians, or
no? But he's gonna see them.
So. I'm gonna see the Point of No Return reunion tour in a few months. So
and see, Larry, you may have missed it. It turns out that Rick has special powers, and he hasn't quite learned to control them yet, but he has the power to make aging rock stars die.
Yeah, oh. Sort of like Carrie, you know, that movie, yeah. Larry.
Oh. Well, I didn't understand the whole thing about Stevie Nicks under Walker, but I don't know very much about Shania Twain's political beliefs. I know she's Canadian.
Yeah, well, she was recently asked what she thought about Trump, and she said, well, you know, I might have voted for him. I think
yeah, but she caught so much shit, she immediately retracted it. You are aware of that, right?
I am aware of that, but it was out there for at least a while. So, yeah. Is she a maggot? Should I like?
No. I think she was just being stupid.
Bob, before we go, I want to let you know that I looked up Bobby Bear, and Bobby Bear was the guy that said that if you drop kick me, remember you were talking about drop kick me Jesus
through the goalpost alive.
Yes, is that Bobby Bear? Because I remember hearing about Bobby Bear when I was listening to Jimmy Rabbit in L.A. playing Outlaw Country, and he would play Bobby Bear. Not necessarily that song, but is that who you remember saying that song?
You know, I remember it being part of the patter that John Denver used to do. I think my memory's good on that. You know, the little talk in between songs, in between Thank God I'm a Country Boy and Country Roads Take Me Home, whatever. He'd tell some story about a little tiny radio station in Texas playing God Drop Kick Me Jesus through the goalposts of life. But that's my best recollection. Larry, it's good to hear from you this evening. And
Thank you.
We had a great group this evening and a delightful, far-ranging, far-reaching conversation. Thanks to everybody for joining in. As ever, thanks to Sparky for moderating. Thank you to VT Blom for coming by. Thanks to Mighty Mouse for popping in. Thanks to Trey in Kentucky Stan. Thank you, Larry. Thanks to Billable Rick, and thanks to Clarity, and thanks to Steve from Georgia Stan. This was a Jim Dandy Friday on the front porch. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thanks to each and every one of you who helps keep this program on the air. Thank you so very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Steve and to Sparky in the chat room, moderators. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a great weekend, everybody.